Hello, this is Matt, and you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. On this month's episode, I'm talking to Dr. Arwen Edwards from Aberystwyth University. Dr. Edwards is an Arctic microbiologist, and we talked through how he started working in the Arctic, what it's like working there, and why it's so important to continue researching this incredible ecosystem.
So my name's Dr. Arwen Edwards, and I'm a senior lecturer in biology at Aberystwyth University, where I lead the Interdisciplinary Centre for Environmental Microbiology. And my main area of work is understanding the interaction between microbes and climate change. And it's an area of research that's taken me to a lot of cold places across the last 15 years or so, starting with my PhD in the Arctic in Svalbard, but most recently 6 weeks in Antarctica, for example. So my research combines fieldwork in cold places and then analysing the samples that we bring back then in our facilities in Aberystwyth University.
My first sort of thoughts is researching in the Arctic, it's got to be a fairly niche area of research. How does someone get into researching in the Arctic?
So I got into researching in the Arctic almost by chance. My first exposure to it was a course in Arctic microbiology where I applied for and I didn't get into because they were full up and they were far better qualified people than me on the list. And I mentioned this to one of the lecturers at my university department, Alexandra Anesio. And he said, well, I'm going to the Arctic in about 6 months' time, and I'll need somebody to help me, basically, and carry things. And you look like you might be able to do that. So I started out as a bag carrier, basically, and I've kind of stuck to it since then. So it's quite common for people to either do a short course at an university like the University Centre in Svalbard, or to stumble into it by just an opportunity to go as a field assistant or through a existing research project as a field assistant.
Right place, right time. Right question, right place, right time.
I think so. That's the really neat thing about Arctic science, is that it's not a hugely pretentious field, and it's one where pragmatic thinking dominates, and a sense of opportunism as well is really important, because you have to be prepared to embrace an element of frontier living to get going with the fieldwork. So the people that get involved with Arctic science tend not to sit on their hands to wait for opportunities. We tend to seek opportunities where we find them.
What's life like in the Arctic?
There's the Arctic and then there's the Arctic. So it's a mixture of different things. I've had 5-star meals prepared by cordon bleu chefs in the Arctic. I've also spent weeks living off freeze-dried ration packs that have gone out of date for several years. The Arctic of the 21st century is quite a varied beast in that sense. So you can flex your... pre-COVID anyway, you could flex your credit card and turn up in the Arctic in a fairly civilised charter plane and just, a semblance of normality. But once you move outside that bubble, you're confronted with many of the same challenges that would have confronted people a century ago. There's very much still two Arctics to be had, two Antarctics to be had as well, between the areas where we've got modern logistics and the areas where you have to fall back on some of the more traditional ways in responding to challenges in the Arctic.
Adventure tourism has grown a lot in the last few years, and that must be contributing to the ease that one can get to the Arctic.
There's the first wave of industrialization and seeking opportunities, whether it was whaling in the Antarctic or mineral exploration in the Arctic, laid down a lot of infrastructure, then followed by in the Arctic Cold War infrastructure. And the third wave now is of course tourism. And it'll be interesting to see how the combined pressures of climate change and of course, a post-COVID world will influence those things, because all along, scientists have had to piggyback onto those investments and that infrastructure to get our work done. It's exceptional to have a science programme which says, OK, we want to go here because the science need is critical to go here, and we must deliver our science independently there. And where you tend to see that more is in Antarctica, where it is the only option, and very quickly you see the bills running up into 6 and 7 figures to provide even access to these places.
I think it's interesting, it might even, as tourism and money grows from tourism and places like that, potentially they might even see that they really do need to protect the Arctic.
It would be the hope, because there's a cruel irony in the idea that people will go for last chance tourism to see something, and in doing so damage that location. As researchers, we're very, very mindful of the carbon footprint that we have going to these places, and also the longevity of an impact in an environment. You know, just a single foot placed in the wrong place can damage really sensitive plants. The impact from research is something that we're really careful to try and minimise, or at least within my research group anyway.
No, that's definitely hugely important, especially in a place as fragile, even though it doesn't seem fragile, as the Arctic, for sure. You've recently had a paper published in one of our journals, the Journal of Microbial Genomics. Could you tell us a little bit about what that research is about?
So we were invited to submit a review to Microbial Genomics, and I decided that the topic should be on what can microbial genomics do in the light of the crisis that we have in the Arctic. The evolution of the review basically took into account a long series of conversations that my research group tends to have within its lab meetings about the things that we feel that could be done, that should be done, that haven't been done, that have possibly not been done in the best way, or important gaps within the field. So I decided that the best way to respond to this invitation was to bring in all the early career researchers in my group that work on Arctic microbiology. And so we took it from there, basically. Our view is that, of course, there's a crisis in the Arctic. The global climate is changing, and both the rate of change and the impact of change already is very accelerated in the Arctic compared to the rest of the planet. And within the Arctic, there are microbial processes which respond to that change and also potentially enhance that change. So microbiology is really important for understanding how the Arctic is changing in such a way that can then influence global climate and Earth systems and the properties of climate change globally. But our feeling was that microbiology sometimes slides down the list somewhat, and particularly the field of genomics slides down the list somewhat in terms of the priorities and attention given to it, even though some of the feedbacks that microbes drive within the Arctic are really critical to that climate response.
And in that research, you talked about four key areas where microbes are playing crucial roles. Could you take us through those?
Yes. So we identified four key areas, and we looked, first of all, in terms of the Arctic Ocean, because, of course, the Arctic is an ocean bounded by Europe and Asia and North America. And the Arctic Ocean is changing very rapidly. It's warming very rapidly, and the extent of sea ice is changing a lot. So there's a very distinctive and critical microbial community associated with sea ice. So we explored what happens when you lose that sea ice community, and also what happens at the moment. We see winter in the Arctic as being a dark and ice-covered state for the Arctic Ocean. What happens if we still have that darkness, because of course polar night, but then we start to lose that sea ice? So we looked at sea ice. The next area we looked at was permafrost, and a lot of attention goes to permafrost and its thawing and its capacity to release methane. But the story is a little bit more complicated, because there's a cycle between microbes making methane and microbes consuming methane. And understanding the different physical and chemical and environmental conditions that allow methane production or methane consumption to dominate needs a genomic perspective. So we felt we could develop that aspect of microbial genomics. Then the third area was the one that's closest to our hearts, because we're specialists in glacier microbial ecosystems. And this is a new field in relative terms, because about 25 years ago, people didn't really appreciate that microbes lived on glaciers. And now we know that microbes grow on ice surfaces and snow surfaces. And on the snow and ice surfaces where they grow, they tend to make them dark. And the influence of that is a little bit like if I had two ice creams in my hands, and one ice cream was vanilla, the other one was chocolate, and I held them out in the sun, the chocolate one would melt faster. And that's a good analogy for the reduction in albedo that we get from microbes growing on the ice surface and from the snow surface. That process of reducing the albedo, or the reflectivity of the ice surface and snow surface, is an important area. The final area that we looked at is a quite a contentious one, and This is the human dimensions of Arctic microbiology. And it's contentious because we like to think often that the Arctic is this vast, pristine white space. But the reality is that humans have been living in the Arctic for thousands of years. And most recently, we've been exploring the Arctic for its mineral resources, for military purposes and so on. And so we've been introducing a range of contaminants. So we are impacting upon that pristine environment to an extent that we can't really call it pristine anymore. And the other angle then is the one that I always get asked about, which is, with all these melting glaciers and thawing permafrost, is there going to be a doomsday pathogen that melts out that kills us all from these environments? And I cringe slightly whenever I hear that, because the evidence base is just so shockingly weak for that, and it flies in the face of so many areas of fundamental microbiology that it is really challenging to build that case. However, people are building that case, and we wanted to give that a bit of a reality check.
It's interesting when you said that the microbes make the ice and the snow darker, because I think one of the areas of that's interesting about global warming is that when the ice starts to melt, there's more sea, which means it absorbs faster. Is that correct?
That's true for sea ice. So that's known as the albedo feedback, or the sea ice albedo feedback. And that's really, really powerful. And that does change the balance of thermal energy around the Arctic Ocean. What we've been looking at in greater detail has been the change in energy balance around terrestrial ice, so glaciers and ice sheets. And these are, of course, responding to climate change in very worrying ways anyway. But our models of how they're responding to climate change have not to date really incorporated biological feedbacks. One of the co-authors of this review, Joseph Cook, has done a lot of work trying to build up a numerical model of how Greenland's ice sheet responds to climate change when you factor in the darkening from the microbes growing on its surface. And it's a small but important addition, which tips the balance quite aggressively in the favour of melting of these ice sheets. The difficulty with this is that we right now are living through an example of the devastating power of a single microbe, and it's very easy to perceive the impact of coronavirus with just its 30,000 nucleotides of RNA and the impact that it's had on human lives and economy across the planet. It's harder to perceive the impact from microbes in their activities for climate change, because there's so many of them and we know so little about them, and their impacts are so varied and so quiet on a day-to-day basis. But ultimately, over the next decades, we're going to have to really look quite closely at microbial processes in climate change to have any hope of confronting climate change.
For sure. And it's interesting what you said there about it being quiet on the day-to-day, because the Arctic and the Antarctic, they're so far away, especially from the UK. You almost, not that you don't forget about them, but it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And it's really interesting for sort of the day-to-day person, someone not researching in the field, to actually sort of think about how important microbiology in the Antarctic and the Arctic is.
I think you're hitting the nail on its head there. And I've called this before the Father Ted problem, because we're dealing with things which are very small and far away. And as a result, they tend to get somewhat neglected. And sometimes when reviewing decisions from funding panels, we get feedback to the effect of, well, hasn't this been done already? Or isn't this self-evident? Or you know, marine microbiologists or terrestrial microbiologists have done this work, or, you know, these are standard methods. But the reality is that the rules of the game are somewhat different in an Arctic environment where things haven't been verified and haven't been implemented, quite simply because there hasn't been that level of investment or resourcing to support it. There's the infrastructure is very limited for doing a lot of this work.
Obviously, climate change and global warming is very important, but I'm just interested, why do you think this type of research is important?
I'm going to give a very biased answer as to why I think this is important. I mean, it's not going to boil down to simply it's been my life's work. I think studying the microbiology of the Arctic is really important because of three different areas. Firstly, climate change, and of course it has immediate relevance for climate change, and secondly, for fundamental microbiology. So one of the questions I was asked in my PhD viva was, you know, what kind of organisms live in these cold places? And the standard term is a psychrophile. And any microbiologist worth their salt should be able to draw a growth curve for a psychrophile compared to a mesophile to a thermophile. But when we actually start digging around and seeing what's actually growing in these places, it becomes a lot harder to understand what makes an effective microbe in an Arctic environment. It isn't simply a case of being able to grow at a low temperature. There's lots of other things to it as well, and the story gets really confused. So there are fundamental areas of microbiology that we can learn from in terms of how microbes grow in the cold. The third reason is our fundamental relationship with our planet. So right now, 80% of our biosphere is colder than a domestic fridge. So the vast area and volume of the biosphere is cold. So we need to understand life in the cold to understand life in the biosphere. But then also we've seen major glaciations throughout the history of life on Earth. And the most recent one, pretty extensive. I'm here in southwest Wales at the moment and right at the edge of where the British-Irish ice sheet reached during the last glacial maximum. But wind the clock back 600 million years and you would have had a extensive glaciation that would have covered the Earth. So snowball Earth or slushball Earth, depending on which school of work you subscribe to. And that happened immediately before the Cambrian explosion. So microbial evolution during snowball Earth is a critical area to explore to understand how complex multicellular animal life started to emerge afterwards. And so you can wind the clock back into the deep reaches of time across the planet and you see microbial process in the cold being really quite important. But you can also push the clock forwards over the next 5, 10, 50, 500 years. And the feedbacks that the microbes are driving in the Arctic right now, they will impact upon how the climate is changing and what we're doing to either make climate change worse or better.
There's sort of two kind of parts in the next question. What are the next steps for the research? And also, where would you like the research to go?
Right now, since we started writing the review, and in revision of the review article, we were able to put a little coda in about the impact of COVID-19. And this has had a massive disruptive effect on virtually every science project that I'm aware of that's seeking to go to the Arctic and Antarctic. For us personally, as a lab, we were aiming to do work in the Arctic over Easter, over summer, and then back in Antarctica over the coming winter. And none of that can happen. So it's having a massive impact on our ability to go to these places to answer quite urgent questions. So we're, for a review that was titled Microbiology in the Arctic Crisis, we're suddenly finding ourselves in another kind of crisis as well. So there's a degree of crisis response to all of this. What are the next steps for research in general? I think microbial genomics has a bit of catching up to do when it comes to the Arctic environment and the polar environment. There are methodologies and approaches and project styles which are considered routine in other environments, but have somewhat lagged behind within the polar environment, perhaps as a function of taking a lot of time to be able to get approvals to do things or plan things. I sense that we need urgently to populate databases with genotypes and phenotypes of Arctic microbes, in some cases before we lose them due to climate change, but certainly to be able to enhance our ability to explore Arctic environments. I think also we need to be able to integrate microbial genomics with other interdisciplinary areas of Arctic science as well. So there's a lot of work being done on modelling, be it by geochemical modelling, how much carbon is flowing around the system, how many nutrients are flowing around the system, but also modelling of the physical environment. And I talked about modelling change in Greenland there as one example. But beneath all of that, the black box of what the microbes are all doing is essentially represented within their genomes. And so understanding their genomic potential is really important to be able to enhance the skill of those models. I think we need to be bringing microbial genomics to the table alongside other areas of Arctic science and Arctic microbiology. So there's a lot of talking to be done within the community, I feel, and hopefully this article plays a very small part in bringing some of those conversations into play.
It's quite interesting that you said Arctic research has a lot of catching up to do. Do you think that's because it's difficult to get out there, or is there another reason?
It's expensive to get to these places, and that's a handicap on any research project that proposes to go to the Arctic or to the Antarctic. So as an example, I could collect a sample in the Arctic, and it's my particular research is very low tech in the field. I need a GPS, and I need a turkey baster, and I need a sterile tube. I can scoop my microbial community using my turkey baster into that tube and record the location with GPS. That's a very fundamental field approach that we use. But to get to that point, the logistics typically requires a chain of helicopter support or small fixed-wing aircraft support, and these things are usually going at about £150 a minute to be able to access them from commercial vendors. And then there's also the consideration around how we do microbiology these days. Everything that a microbiologist will want to collect for doing molecular work needs to be frozen and needs to be chemically preserved potentially as well. And so everybody's been doing research on a scoop and run basis, where you have your turkey baster, you collect your sample, and then it needs to go into a freezer and then it's thawed out in your lab, which is not hugely problematic if you've got a cold chain. However, the cruel irony of the Arctic is that relatively few places can actually support freezing of samples, certainly freezing at minus 80 or the kind of temperatures that you need to be looking at RNA or metabolite turnover. So it's very difficult to go out into the field and then collect your samples, not knowing whether your samples will arrive home in one piece and not knowing whether your samples will have degraded in the meantime. So we've been looking a lot at bringing the molecular biology lab to the samples instead. And we've been doing a lot of work on portable nanopore sequencing. And that's an area that we're exploring quite strongly as well, in terms of being able to analyse the genomes and metagenomes of these organisms on site, rather than trying to cold chain samples back to the UK.
Thank you to Dr. Edwards for appearing on the show. The article we discussed is really interesting, and if you want to read it and find out more, I'll leave a link to it in the podcast description below. We're continuing to put out as much content as possible, so keep looking at our Twitter account to see what's new. As always, I hope you're keeping safe, and I'll see you on the next episode.